The Escape Pod. Let's go on a trip through time to see what tomorrow looked like yesterday.
Preparing escape pod for launch.
Today was yesterday's tomorrow.
Pressurizing.
Where we are now used to be the unimaginable future.
Fuel.
Nominal.
And today's outdated entertainment used to be yesterday's state of the art.
Power.
Nominal.
Sifting through science fact and science fiction, from outdated technology to the birth of the future. Let's get away from it all for a few minutes by going back the way we came, into logbook.com's escape pod. The logbook.com's escape pod is once again in orbit, observing the futuristic, the fantastic, and the formative moments in geek history. I'm Earl Green, and it's time once again to see what tomorrow looked like yesterday. On this day in 1966, we got a good look at Earth. The first NASA ATS, or Applications Technology Satellite, took the first photo of Earth from geosynchronous orbit, showing the entire face of the planet for the first time. ATS-1 also conducted some of the earliest tests of satellite navigation technology. In 1972, the last Apollo lunar landing mission lifted off from Cape Canaveral, Apollo 17.
We'll get a final guidance release at the T-minus 17 second mark. T-minus 17, final guidance release. We'll expect engine ignition at 8.9 seconds. 10, 9, 8, 7, ignition sequence started. All engines are started. We have ignition, 2, 1, 0. We have a liftoff. We have a liftoff, and it's lighting up the area. It's just like daylight here at Kennedy Space Center as the Saturn V is moving off the pad. It is now clear of the tower.
This would be the first time a scientist accompanied the usual crew of test pilots to the moon, in this case, geologist Harrison Schmitt.
My glad I took my hand off that abort handle.
Oh, man!
So am I.
And in 1995, Galileo's probe tasted the clouds of Jupiter.
Probe confirmed 693.
That's the confirmation.
That was a single yes or no.
Okay, one down.
That was a call from the probe engineering team chief, Pat Melia, which said very simply that we had indications that the orbiter receiver had locked onto a signal. Of course, we presume it's from the probe. So...
A specially designed atmospheric entry probe carried by Galileo sliced through the giant planet's stormy clouds at a speed of 100,000 miles per hour, taking the first ever direct measurements of Jupiter. The entry probe survived nearly an hour, surviving winds of at least 450 miles per hour, and returned, get this, 460 kilobytes of readings to NASA. Dutch astronomer Gerard Kuiper was born on this day in 1905, and he rewrote a lot of what we know about our solar system during his lifetime. In addition to discovering one moon each of Uranus and Neptune, he was also the first to detect a methane atmosphere around Titan, a giant moon of Saturn, and he sat on the NASA committee to select Apollo landing sites. He's best known for his theory about what we now call the Kuiper Belt, a ring of ancient icy bodies orbiting in the outermost reaches of the solar system. Lee Brackett, co-writer of The Empire Strikes Back, was born on this day in 1915. She died before the movie was released. Rube Goldberg died on this day in 1970, famous for his cartoons depicting overly complicated devices to perform ridiculously mundane tasks. In 1979, the human adventure was, or so the advertising for the movie said, just beginning.
It will startle your senses, challenge your intellect, and alter your perception of the future by taking you there. Star Trek, the motion picture, rated G.
Star Trek The Motion Picture brought a reworked Enterprise and her crew to the big screen in an epic science fiction adventure to the delight of longtime Star Trek fans everywhere. While the first Star Trek movie was mysterious and brainy, its premiere saw fans flocking into theaters, but it's still regarded as a financial flop since Paramount charged the development of every failed Star Trek movie and TV project in the 1970s against it, a classic case of creative Hollywood accounting. It was also the last time Gene Roddenberry would be in unquestioned control of a Star Trek project until the late 80s. In 1981, near the end of the show's run, the heroes of Blake 7 turned against each other.
What's the position now, Orak?
Remaining flight time, 5 minutes and 40 seconds.
How much more weight must we lose before we can achieve escape velocity?
70 kilos, Avon.
Only 70 kilos. Villa, strip off the insulation material in the cargo hold. Villa!
Well, that's plastic, it weighs nothing.
Get rid of it anyway.
A kilo and a half, if we're lucky.
Do it! We've got 5 minutes! Not enough, not nearly enough. Damn it, what weighs 70 kilos?
Villa weighs 73 kilos, Avon.
The episode Orbit was the second from last in the show's fourth and final season, and was the last to be written by Robert Holmes, who is best known for writing some of the best Doctor Who scripts. And in 1984, another momentous discovery at Jupiter.
How are you going to convince your people to allow Americans to go on the flight?
We are going to get there first, and you have the knowledge to make the trip work.
I'm going on the flight.
How far away is Jupiter?
Far.
Mommy said you're going to be asleep for a long time. Are you going to die?
Dr. Floyd. Dr. Floyd. Dr. Arlov has encountered some strange data coming from Europa.
I'll send Max down with a pod.
I wouldn't do that.
Oh, really?
If you want to send a pod down there, send an unmanned one.
If this data is correct, then there's something down there.
It is correct.
It was organic. There was life.
Is it moving?
Yes.
It's incredible.
Listen for a minute. We've got to get out of here.
I can't just order us to leave here for no reason.
Forget reason. There's no time to be reasonable.
Can't find him!
Are you sure you are making the right decision? I think we should stop.
In 2010, The Year We Make Contact premiered today in 1984 with an all-star cast including Roy Scheider and John Lithgow, and the unenviable task of following up on 2001 A Space Odyssey and explaining one of the most famously cryptic movie endings of all time. In 1987, it was time for a new face in the TARDIS.
Ace, where do you think you're going?
Perivale.
Ah, yes, but by which route? The direct route or the scenic route? Do you fancy a quick trip round the 12 galaxies and then back to Perivale in time for tea?
Ace!
But there are 3 rules. 1, I'm in charge.
Whatever you say, Professor.
2, I'm not the Professor, I'm the Doctor.
Whatever you want.
And the third?
Well, I'll think up the third by the time we get back to Perivale.
Sophie Aldred joined Doctor Who as new time-traveling companion Ace. In 1992, Captain Picard was trapped.
You should prove an interesting challenge. Possibly the most interesting to come through that door in many years.
What do you want?
Why, you, of course. Picard. Jean-Luc. Serial number. SP-937-215. Formerly captain of the Stargazer. Don't look so surprised. How could we have designed a lure for the captain of the Federation flagship unless we knew something about his background?
So you concocted an elaborate ruse to bring me here. Why?
In this room, you do not ask questions. I ask them. You answer. If I am not satisfied with your answers, you will die.
David Warner guest starred as a Cardassian interrogator in the first part of an intense story about political prisoners and torture on Star Trek The Next Generation. You can read about these events and many more on thelogbook.com's ever-evolving timeline of geek history. Our latest book, Warp 1, is available now. Thelogbook.com's extensive guide to the universe of Gene Roddenberry's Star Trek, including the original series, animated series, the movies, The Next Generation, Roddenberry's one-off TV projects, and much more. You can pick up other original books and DVDs and hundreds of other titles in the logbook.com store anytime. Thanks for listening to the Escape Pod.
Commencing escape pod landing procedure. The logbook.com escape pod was written and produced by Earl Green.
Okay, we've got absolute confirmation. We are there. We've had a successful burn.
No, we're there and we're going to stay there.
We're there. This is great. I mean, I say everybody's very, very happy right now. The big push, the big events of the day have now occurred, and they've occurred successfully.
When there was, when orbital ignition began, but not yet achieving orbit, Dan Golden was giving high fives to people who I don't think had ever had a high five in their lives.
It looks like this was extremely precise. That's a lot of credit goes to our German colleagues and the precision of that rocket and machine that they built, and all of our attitude control and mission team engineers. It looks like everything was right on the money.
And it all working after such a long period of time in space.
That's right, space and on the ground.
And on the ground, unanticipated delays.
Well, this has been a big day for Jupiter as well as for us. It saw its first artificial shooting star, and now it has its first artificial satellite.
I suspect Jupiter is very blasé about such immense stars.
Well, actually, give us a little bit of perspective on that. A lot of the questions we get are, is Galileo going to search for life? What are the prospects of life in the Jovian system? And maybe you can give us a little bit of a perspective on that.
Well, I mean, the first thing to say is that nobody knows. And if we did know, you would have heard about it before now. I don't think it's out of the question. It's not something to be dismissed by contemplating your navel. You dismiss it by doing investigations. And Galileo turns out to be a very powerful instrument. Where might we look? Possible subsurface ocean of Europa that you guys were talking about before is a very interesting environment. If there's liquid water, it's roughly room temperature. It's in the dark, all right, but there are cracks and maybe light gets down, and beyond that we now know of ecosystems on the Earth that live in the dark in the ocean bottoms. And while we're not going to send some part of Galileo down subsurface, there's a very good chance of elucidating much better our knowledge of what's happening on Europa. Then on Jupiter, the minimal statement you might make safely is that organic chemistry is happening. We know of some simple hydrocarbons in the atmosphere. We know from laboratory simulations, our laboratory at Cornell and elsewhere, that if you UV irradiate or charged particle irradiate or lightning irradiate a Jovian atmosphere, you get a very nice mixture of complex organics.
And including amino acids.
Including amino acids if you're down in the liquid water clouds. Now, we have almost no data from the liquid water clouds. We're not only going to have data from there, we're going to have a probe passing into it, through it, and getting organic chemistry from somewhere in the vicinity of it. So even if the abundance of organic chemicals in the free atmosphere is low, because of lightning in the water clouds and for other reasons, you might expect there to be higher amounts in the water clouds. That's going to be very exciting. And if there isn't any organic chemistry there, that's very interesting. How come? Why not? And then the most wild speculation, which I can legitimately describe it as such since I did it with my colleague Saul Peter of Cornell, is that there might be life in the atmosphere of Jupiter. And if there is substantial organic chemistry and there's stuff to eat, And there are ways that are easy to imagine of organisms not being rapidly carried down to their depths at, you know, great depths. No guarantee, of course, and certainly no guarantee that we would find it. But still, it's a possibility to bear in mind. Even if there were no organic chemistry and no biological possibilities, Galileo is going to do wonders. It's, from my point of view, it's sort of like it's your birthday. And your parents have permitted you to see that there's this big pile of presents, but you can't open them yet. And you're going to have to open them slowly on pre-assigned times. Mm-hmm. And that's the story we're in. We don't know what's in them, but we know that it's going to be great.
And they'll let you run through the room a few days earlier to see those presents. You want to go back and start unwrapping them.
Right. And you can't. The absolute law of nature that it's not permitted until a certain time. And that's the same situation we're in. Okay. Another thing I think about, Rich, is, you know, only 1,000 years ago, nobody thought of Jupiter as a world. It was a point of light in the sky. It was a god. It was a spirit. It wasn't a place. And we really knew nothing about it. Cultures all over the world identified it with the king of the gods. Well, it's not the king of the gods. We're quite sure of that now. But look what it is. It's this giant world, a kind of star that failed. And as Torrance said a moment ago, very different from the Earth and the other inner planets in the solar system. And there we are at it, finding out what it's about. And in just this last few months, there has been a credible announcement of a discovery of another Jupiter-like planet around a very different star, 51 Pegasi.
That's right.
And so what we're doing here is not just studying the Jupiter in our system, but in a certain sense, the whole category of Jupiters, of which, if the 51 Pegasi discovery is right, there must be an enormous number around nearby stars. So there's a whole new genre, category of things to explore. It's an epical time in the history of human exploration.